Hey, this is WTOP's Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by just say your name and your title.
Dan Mirvish,
the director of 18 and a half. Nice play on Fellini's 18 and a half title. But it opens in DC, I believe, on June 3rd with a special sneak peek on June 1st.
That's right.
I guess just tell us, I mean, the timing for this is perfect. The 50th anniversary of Watergate break-ins coming up on June 17th, and you're opening the same month, so that's great. But I just watched it, but why don't you tell our listeners the basic premise?
Sure. It's about a young woman in the Nixon White House in 1974 who gets a hold of the missing 18 and a half minute gap and wants to leak it to a reporter, but they run afoul of hippies, swingers, and nefarious forces out to get them. It is historical fiction, but definitely uses a lot of real research on the Watergate backdrop to the whole thing.
I love it. And I'm sure there's a lot of our listeners that are going to, you know, being here in DC and, you know, drive by the Watergate every day. So they're probably some, you know, Nixon history junkies and all that stuff. So I'm sure they're going to love it. How did you come up with it? I mean, it was obviously it's you and Daniel Moya. I guess you share a story credit.
Yeah.
Did he write the screenplay or did you guys write it together?
Yeah. So he did the lion's share of the screenplay, and cause I was busy, you know, finishing up my last film. But yeah, the story was kind of, you know, came about. I'd been fascinated by Watergate since I was a kid, you know, back when the Senate hearings, you know, were on TV wall to wall. And then I majored in history and political science. And I actually, one of my professors was Thomas Eagleton, who had been McGovern's first running mate until he wasn't. And then I worked in DC for a couple of years. I was a speechwriter for Senator Tom Harkin. And so I just really loved the whole DC, you know, political culture and have been thinking about Watergate for a long time. But then this was kind of precipitated because the last film I did called Bernard and Huey was written by Jules Pfeiffer, who was a great cartoonist, political cartoonist, won a Pulitzer Prize for that. Specifically about his cartoons about Nixon Watergate, and that kind of inspired me to do this film. And then we found this great location, the Silver Sands Motel, which in the film is in St. Michael's, Maryland, but in real life is actually on the tip of Long Island.
Okay. I was gonna ask about that. No, it's funny because you do sense a little bit of I was wondering what your DC tie was, because I knew what it said you grew up in Wisconsin or whatever, but watching the movie, you know, with some of the lines or the accents or hey hun or, you know what I mean, like I was like he has to know the area a little bit, and so that makes sense. You were speaking. Well cool, no one would have known it was in Long Island. It totally plays, man.
thanks.
Well, tell me about the casting really quick. There's so much of, you know, directing I want to go into with you because I geek out on my stuff. But let's start with the casting. Faces people will remember, you know, Willa Fitzgerald from Reacher and John Magaro. Is it Magaro? Is that how you
Magaro,
say it?
Yeah.
Man, I got to say, First Cow. He's in First Cow. First Cow, yeah. It's so underrated. Kelly Reichardt should have been nominated for like everything that year. I loved it.
and she's the one who recommended him to me. So
really? So how did that come up? I need that story.
Well, I know Kelly just a little bit, but we were considering John and I was like, hey, how is he to work with? And she's like, oh, he's great. You should cast him. I was like, all right, I'll take her word for it. And Willa Fitzgerald, you know, she was recommended by another director friend, Lucky McKee, as well as her agent. And then she did the Reacher thing afterwards and really kind of her career took off a little bit more after that. And then people like Richard Kind are in it. Richard was in my last film, so I kind of knew him. The great Vondi Curtis Hall was recommended by his agent. And then we have some incredible voice talents.
Tell me. I'll just to break up the sound bites. Tell me about the voices on the you know, the infamous 18 and a half minute tape. You recreate the tape, but tell us some famous voices. I don't know if you want to call it Easter egg, but if you listen closely enough, you'll hear some famous voices on the tape.
Sure. So it's Ted Raimi as General Al Haig. It's John Cryer from Two and a Half Men and Pretty in Pink. He plays H.R. Bob Haldeman, and of course Bruce Campbell as the voice of Richard Nixon himself.
I mean, those are nice, juicy little like extra treats where you're getting. I'm hearing it. I'm like, I recognize those voices, and how do I know?
Yeah, Yeah.
But there you go. And even the name, I mean, it'll, any fans of, you know, All the President's Men or any of that, or just that grew up reading and watching the coverage of the Watergate, well, you know, the names like Haldeman and everything, it's just a treat to hear all that. Well, cool. Well, I said I wanted to go into some directing things. The opening shot where you have, you know, you have your protagonist, you know, Willa Fitzgerald's character sitting in the car. I loved how you did it. It's, you're like messing with us as viewers, you know, even smart, literate, you know, cinephile viewers will be like, wait a minute, the car is clearly not moving. Like some folks might even be like, you like goat them into thinking, oh, that's like a bad green screen. The car's not moving. And then all of a sudden you realize with the slow disclosure, as Scharf would say, the slow disclosure of, you realize she's just on a ferry.
Yeah.
So take me into the idea to do that. Were you intentionally trying to mess with our senses there?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. No. I. Because I had taken that ferry from Shelter Island, where Pfeiffer lives, to Greenport, New York, and I noticed this bizarre sense you get of is it you know, because people sit behind the wheel of their cars, and yet you're moving sideways and forward, and it's very unnatural. So yeah, that was definitely a way to kind of draw people into sort of, you know, we're going to be playing with your senses here and you know, dive right into the movie.
Yeah, I love a movie where you can tell right from the beginning that you're in the hands of a strong director. And I know a lot of people, a lot of people probably don't care. They're more into the story or whatever. But I truly believe that that stuff sort of works subconsciously, even if you're not aware of it. And then if you are aware of it, as sort of like a mise-en-scène cinephile guy, like you or Yao, you really, really, I don't know. I think there's more, I buy into the movie. I'm like, oh, let's see what this guy's doing. Like there's, yeah. I noticed like some other cool touches, like when you're, when she comes up to the motel counter and you see your face, like in a reflection on something on the counter, you know, there's a lot of cool things that you had. Did you have like an overall, you know, directing approach in terms of like the camera sort of sitting back, sort of lurking, sort of pushing in when they're listening to the tape, pulling out? I mean, in terms of like a general directing approach to it, did you want more like an observing sort of camera?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I definitely believe in most of my films, but especially this one, the camera is a character. We, you know, the audience is pulled in. Connie is our, you know, everything is kind of through her perspective, but the camera is still kind of our own, you know, subjective point of view. But my feeling, and this is what I told everyone on the cast and crew, from the writing, the actors and music, is we were only going to use creative techniques that could have been done and would have been done in 1974. So there's no drone shots, there's no steady cam, because that was 76. You know, so there's a lot of zooms in there, because that was really, you know, that was very common in that era. And I just like that. I just like that as a style. But everything to the musical instruments were all period appropriate. We do have a lot of bossa nova music, as you can tell in the film, all original. You know, I wrote the lyrics of the songs. My buddy Luis Guerra is our composer, you know, live horn section, you know, the costumes. We had a great costume designer, Sarah Kogan, who collects old original patterns, paper patterns, and then she would make new costumes from those old patterns, and then just a fantastic production design across the board.
Oh yeah. For sure. It all works. And I'm sure it was fun, you know, going back and putting yourself in the, not only the early 70s period production design stuff, but like you said, I think it's really cool that even like you even capped it off on what directing technique, camera techniques you would use. Mm-hmm. Like you just said, the Steadicam wasn't until 1976 with, what was it, Rocky and Bound for Glory.
Yeah, Rocky. Yeah.
What was the other one? There was like three, I think, that used it.
Yeah, there were a couple that came out that year.
But anyway, I love that you're saying like you tried to only use camera techniques before that. I love that. I really geek out about that. Well, very cool. Very cool. In terms of like the way the story unfolds, yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, but I guess, how do I say generally, in general terms,
weird.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. Talk about how you and your writer go about crafting some things that might seem like humorous or amusing interludes where they're meeting other characters, like particularly the you know, affectionate couple, that, you know, the right. Monty Curtis Hall, right. Catherine Curtin couple, and there's the other characters too. But talk about how you as a filmmaker, on the surface, you're trying to create something that seems like a humorous interlude, but that can then come back and pay off later. Like, that's an art right there.
Well, thank you. Thanks. I mean, we really all just tried to play around with the tone. You know, it's a thriller, but it's also a comedy. Connie's character, you know, the character of Connie just kind of goes through the looking glass and meets all these weird people, you know, the hippies, the swingers, and you know, one-eyed Jack, you know, Richard Kind. But I think the key was that Willa Fitzgerald's performance and John McGarro really play it straight the whole time. And that's, I think, where the humor comes from.
Yep, absolutely. Well, you know, I encourage folks to check it out. When is it? I want to ask some other stuff about, you know, your past films and the rest of your career and Slam Dance and everything like that. But just before, you know, while we're still talking 18 and a half, tell us about the screening again. Is the sneak peek thing on June 1st? Is that something that our listeners will be able to go to?
Or absolutely. Yeah, that's open to the public. That's going to be at the Landmark East Street Theater in D.C. in the district. And that's, I think it's 7 or 7:30, on June 1st, Wednesday. And I'm going to be doing the Q&A along with my, writing partner, Daniel Moya, and, one of our executive producers, Paul Orzelak, who's in DC. And we may have some special guests, academics or journalists, specifically talking about Watergate afterwards. So we're working on that as well. And then starting June 3rd, it opens at the Regal Majestic Silver Spring. And then there's also going to be one screening at the Alamo Draft House in Arlington, the Arlington Draft House.
Awesome.
Sunday, I think.
So you can see it in DC on the 1st with your Q&A, or you can mm-hmm. see it later that weekend, I guess on June 3rd in Silver Spring, and then also over in Arlington. See, that's cool. Yeah. You hit the DC, Maryland, Virginia trifecta. That's
absolutely
great. Very smart. Well, I'd love to, if you have a second, go a little into, you know, your journey as a filmmaker in general, your sort of career. Maybe we'll provide some fodder that'll spark some questions that our listeners will ask you at the Q&A if they listen to this. So yeah. Just tell me, we mentioned earlier you grew up in Wisconsin, but how did you discover filmmaking? Like, did you always love movies as a kid, or, you know, how did that happen?
I was born in Wisconsin, but pretty much grew up in Nebraska and Omaha. And, I mean, there weren't a lot of art houses to see, you know, independent film there. But then when I went to college in St. Louis, that's really where I got into, I took a Super 8 class and really loved that. And then was involved with the student group that showed films on campus. I did some summer classes at UCLA. But then I had done an internship in DC my junior year and really fell in love with DC. And so when I graduated, came out and interned for a little while and wrote for the Washington Monthly magazine for a few months, and then got this job working for Harkin. And actually, even doing as a speechwriter in the Senate, we recorded a lot of the speeches on video in the basement of the Capitol. There's a couple different recording studios there. And so that kind of, you know, not that those were like super creative videos, but you know, I would hang out with the guys in the booth and they're like, yeah, dude, you should apply to film school. And and I knew, you know, look, I knew in DC, by the time you hit 30, someone just gives you a 3-piece suit and a law degree. So I, you know, by osmosis. And I was like, you know, let me go back to this film thing and see how that turns out. And so then I went to USC film school.
I love it. I love it. And that's cool. I'm glad that you took their advice, or we would have missed that on these movies. So, well, cool. So I know, it makes sense now that you mentioned you grew up in Omaha, because that was, you know, your early film in 95 was called Omaha. I read somewhere in your bio, IMDb, somewhere along the way, something I was reading, was saying you were mentored by Altman when you were making that. What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My first film, Omaha, the movie. Yeah. Cause I ran into Robert Altman's grandson, Dana Altman, who lives in Omaha. So he became my producing partner, still is one of my producing partners, cool. Even on 18 and a half. And then his grandfather, Robert Altman, kind of mentored us on that first film. And, you know, I certainly got to know him and learned a lot of techniques that I still to this day incorporate, like miking actors individually and recording, letting them do overlapping, you know, dialogue. That's definitely come straight from Altman himself.
I was just going to, that's the first thing I think about. And you said it, and we're sharing a brain. You said it. Yeah, the miking multiple actors. What he used it. He was so genius. The way I guess what in MASH and McCabe
Nashville
and Miller and Nashville. Yep. I love Nashville. Gosh, we were just talking to Jeff Goldblum about him starting about Nashville. The silent motorcycle man or whatever.
Right.
The player. There's so many. So, but that's I'm tangenting. But that's so great that you had Altman and his grandson as as a mentor and producing partner. That's fantastic. Cool. And then I saw that you veered into some musicals too. So it's not just, all White House, gritty, could have gone the gritty, I don't know, all the president type movies right away, but instead you did some musicals, Open House in 2004, Half Empty in 2006. Remind our listeners what those musical projects were about.
Well, Open House was a real estate musical, with, Sally Kellerman, who'd been in MASH, and Anthony Rapp from Rent. Real low budget, but we had a lot of fun with that one. And then it's a long story, but that was eligible for an Oscar for Best Original Musical. But in order to activate that category, there needed to be 5 eligible films, and we could only find 3 others. So well, screw it. Let's just make another one real quick. And so we did. We went to Germany and made a bad German musical because we couldn't take votes away from our first film because 3 of the films would be eligible. Anyway, so we made a bad German musical in 9 days. It was like a real life version of The Producers. And that was this film, Half Empty. And then tried to get the Academy to activate the category. And then they didn't, but then they rewrote the rules. They have, I call it the Mervish rule in there, that now says we can activate the category if we so choose to activate the category, but it's still on the books and they've just still never activated it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. As a huge Oscar nut myself, I haven't seen that category Best Original Musical. So yeah, I like how you were trying to jumpstart it with 2 of your own movies competing against each other.
Yeah, why not, man?
Why not? But stay, I'm sure it was a really cool, rewarding experience to get to do.
It was,
musical.
It was fun.
And then similar, kind of in the same vein of, you think musicals, you think Broadway. Well, you'd adapted an off-Broadway play, not a musical, but a play Between Us in 2012. Right. Remind us what that was about.
Yeah, that was 2 couples yelling and throwing things at each other. And it was a great off-Broadway play by Joe Hortua, and he and I collaborated on the adaptation of that, and I directed it. And, for the film, we had Julia Stiles and David Harbour and Melissa George and Taye Diggs. And that one's a pretty heavy drama. We thought it was supposed to be a bit of a dark comedy, but nobody laughed. So we just went and told everyone it was a drama. But it was, but it was great. I mean, fantastic performances by some of, the world's best actors. And that was a lot of fun to work on.
Awesome. And I mean, we'd be here all day if we went into all your projects, but maybe let's hit one more and we'll bring it back around 18 and a half. I guess more recently, you mentioned it earlier, Bernard and Huey, I guess it came out in 2017. You worked with the acclaimed, Pulitzer cartoonist, writer, Jules Pfeiffer. I guess Pfeiffer also wrote Carnal Knowledge.
Carnal Knowledge has
some really cool credits.
Predating
this too. Just what was it like working with Pfeiffer? I mean, that's you probably learned a lot.
Oh my gosh, yeah, incredible. I mean, he is still an amazing figure. And this was a script he had written 30 years earlier that had been lost, and it took us like a year and a half just to find the script.
Well, what do you mean lost? Like put it in a drawer and then everybody forgot about it?
Pretty much. Yeah. He'd been divorced a couple times. Everything was in storage. He'd kind of lost it, but we eventually found a handwritten copy of it at the Library of Congress, had it in their archives. And he had forgotten that he had donated some of his archives to the Library of Congress. So I sent a buddy of mine in DC there. We got a copy of it. And then we were like, oh yeah, well now let's make this thing, So
I'm picturing, go with me here. It's when you mentioned the Library of Congress, I'm picturing you and Pfeiffer sitting there in the library, and you probably know where I'm going with this, and the camera's pulling up all the president's men. There you're like, we found it.
Yeah, it was like that. It's just kind of buried in there, but they've got some fantastic archives there, and most people don't know about it.
My one problem with that shot, and I don't want to say problem because that's one of the best movies ever, and Pakula is amazing, but I wish they could have had time to just stay the shot going all the way up. I think they use like some dissolves.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, there's 2 dissolves in there. Yeah, I know. But it's such a beautiful shot and beautifully constructed.
It really is. I'm sure there was a producer or studio head somewhere along the way. It's too long.
Right.
Which I guess that will segue back to the mid 70s techniques that you used for 18 and a half.
Right.
Right. Well, very cool. Very cool. Well, that brings us to present day. And before we run, we should tell our listeners that you're also the founder, or I guess, is it co-founder of the Slam Dance Film Fest? Obviously, you know, take on the name of the Sundance, but, you know, what made it different from Sundance? What was sort of the mission of, you know, hey, here's Sundance, but here we are as well.
Well, we started it in the mid 90s, and it was at a time when sort of independent film was going Hollywood, was you know, bigger budgets, and Miramax had just become part of Disney, and Fineline had become part of Warner Brothers, and Sundance was kind of going along. They're like, woohoo, we're going Hollywood. And so they left behind the niche of the first time directors, low budgets with no big names actors in it, and we kind of stepped in and kind of filled that niche that was the original, you know, kind of purpose of Sundance. And we've now been doing it for 28 years or however many years it's been, and through that we've shown the first films of Bong Joon-ho, Christopher Nolan, the Russo brothers, Ryan Johnson, the late Lynn Shelton, the Safdie brothers, Sean Baker, all kinds of interesting people. And so we just keep doing it right next to Sundance across the street from them.
That's so cool. And yeah, like you said, I mean, there became a point where Sundance wasn't really as independent as it used to be. And so that's kind of cool that you do it across the street from it. And you rattled off some really legendary filmmakers that got their helped get their start at your festival. But could you, just for my purposes for the radio, you know, so I have like an anecdote. Can you share a story on one of those, like when Bong Joon-ho or Christopher Nolan, just pick one or two and talk about that movie and that experience? Like, oh my God, I found that on the ground floor and I was just blown away, kind of a story.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher Nolan, we showed his first film, Following, which was a little low budget film he'd done in London, and he showed up and there were 14 people in the audience, and he's like, oh, hello, why is nobody here? And I was like, dude, because you got to pass out some flyers, you know, go down to Kinko's, make some flyers and pass them out up and down the street. And he did. And, you know, the next screening he had, there were a lot more people, I think, including Roger Ebert. So, but yeah, no, all these guys, you know,
and that's pre-Memento, right? This is pre.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It was the year before Memento. So they just, everybody starts out small and gets bigger. You know, Ryan Johnson was a PA, production assistant on Omaha the Movie, on my first film.
Really?
So, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So he's doing okay.
Yeah, I think he's doing all right. Well, that's really cool. I love to hear all the little tie-ins. And then I guess just sort of in closing, then how is running that festival sort of influenced or helped you as a filmmaker? You know, not only the cast and crew connections like you're talking about, Ryan Johnson worked on your movie, but it's got to help just seeing quality submissions and I guess and not so quality as well. But, you know, just seeing what's good, the latest, you know, crop every year, it's got to help you as a director, too, and a writer.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's great being influenced by younger and other, you know, filmmakers from around the world and seeing sort of what the latest techniques and, you know, both creatively, but also in terms of distribution, things like that. And it's where I've met a lot of my collaborators over the years. A lot of my cinematographers are people that I met there. So.
Great. And then I guess final seconds, if there's anyone listening to this in our area, or heck, they could listen to it wherever around the country or world. What's your advice to them if there's a young filmmaker, a young screenwriter, you know, that is submitting to Slam Dance or whatever, or about to make a movie, or if they want to go into film school, whatever, like, is there like a certain advice you have for folks, like, you know, like to tell, you know, write what you know, or whatever, you know what I mean? Like what's your canned answer for when people come saying, how should I get into this?
Marry well.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for, you know, taking the detour into that and then connecting it back around to 18 and a half. It's all of a piece in my mind, so I appreciate it. And congrats on the movie. Again, everyone, it's called 18 and a half. Dan Mervish, thank you. This was so much fun. Is there anything else you want to add before?
No. No, that's it, Jason. Thank you so much for having me on. And, you know, I think this is a film that people in DC are going to appreciate one way or another. But it's, you know, but it's not a historical documentary. It's fiction. So it's a fun ride. But I hope people take it with us.
Right. And just enough reality and just enough fiction for a good time. So, all right. Cool. Dan Mervish, thanks so much. This was great.
All right. Thanks, man.